Good morning. So last time we started off by talking about LEAs, load effective address. We learned that effective addresses are addresses that are computed as part of running an instruction. So like if we have a move instruction that moves a value from a register into memory, part of running that instruction is figuring out what's the address in memory to access to store a value, and that address is an effective address. So load effective address, like that move instruction, has an effective address, an address we compute in the middle, but rather than actually using that address to access memory or something like that, we just take that address and store it in the destination register. And this often causes confusion, which is why I went over it, because it looks like an instruction that's accessing memory, and it doesn't. And because often this instruction is used by compilers to do computation. Because it turns out, if you don't actually access memory, the processor doesn't care about whether values that are quote-unquote supposed to be addresses really are valid addresses. And compilers will take advantage of this and say, well, you do a computation, let's do that computation that maybe was designed for addresses, but it's useful for other things. And therefore, LEA is often used in that capacity for this non-address computation. We also talked a bunch about condition codes. So we said, well, you've learned before probably that, oh, you can do this compare conditional jump thing. And there was a question about how that works, because compare and conditional jump, those are two different instructions. And somehow the conditional jump knows what happened in the compare. And the way that happens is with these special condition code registers. So these are one-bit registers that store information about the results of the last arithmetic. And we mentioned sort of the two most important for this class are the zero flag, also known as ZF, and the sign flag, also known as SF. So the zero flag is, was the last result zero? And the sign flag was the last result negative? Or alternately, you can think of it as a copy of the sign bit from the last results. There's also some flags related to overflow, OF and CF. We're not going to go into when they're set and when they're not, but I want you to know that, yes, it handles overflow. Otherwise, you know, the compare instruction wouldn't work correctly. And I said it's arithmetic. So it turns out that most arithmetic sets this, but typically you think of using it with compare. So what does compare do related to arithmetic? It turns out compare is subtract, but rather than storing the result of the subtraction, it doesn't, but it still sets the condition codes the same way subtract would. And our conditional jump instructions are named after what happens with subtracting, or alternately you can think of them as being named after comparing our result to zero. So jump if equal checks the zero flag. Because if the zero flag is one, then two values we subtracted gave us a zero, which was meant that they were the same. Or alternately, you know, if the zero flag's one, then the value we just computed is equal to zero. And that's what jump if equal is checking. For example, and all the other conditional jump instructions you're probably used to are named after what happens with subtraction, because that's what the compare operation is. And that's equivalent to saying they're named after comparing with zero. We also started talking about, well, now that we know how actual conditional instructions work, looking at converting control flow through assembly. This is probably something you did before in 2150, but we wanted to go over it for sake of making it, you know, less, you know, something that's in your mind, because we're going to see, you know, a bunch of assembly code with conditionals. We want to know, like, what does that correspond to in C and vice versa. So questions about these things we covered last time. So we kind of glossed over one part of converting control flow to assembly last time, which was about loops. So we talked about how to do it with sort of if else. With loops, it's the same kind of principle. So my mechanism for doing this, not the only way, is I'm going to sort of convert each line to simpler C code that uses if and go to, just if go to or go to. And the way that's going to work here is I'm going to say, oh, sometimes you want to skip over this code, So I have if that condition is not true, go to the end of the loop. I'm going to remember that at the end of the loop, I want to go back to the beginning, so I add a go to. So this is my sort of straightforward conversion into sort of simpler C code. And like before with ifs, this simpler C code is something where it's very straightforward to look up instructions and convert each line directly. So for example, we know, because we learned about compare and conditional jump, that this first line corresponds to a pair of those instructions. So I end up with a translation like this. I said, oh, if x less than 0, we saw that before. I'm going to just look up the compare instructions, and it turns out that this pretty directly corresponds to a compare and conditional jump. This call corresponds pretty directly to this subtract, and then this go to here corresponds very directly to a jump. So we've converted it to a form where the translation should at least be straightforward after that. Some questions about this translating our while loop all the way to this assembly? Why do you use R12? I've just chosen that X is an R12. But yes, yeah, so just a choice I made. And I chose R12 instead of some other register because it's call E saved. So I don't have to push or pop it around the call here. Other questions? Okay, so like I said, when we introduced why we're using C, you know, there's this straightforward translation to assembly that I've kind of shown you, which is why we're using C, but it's not the only option. In particular, if you say compile, you have this loop here, which loops B going up to 10 from something, calling foo, and here's our straightforward translation. Basically looks like what we would get out of that other result, assuming B was an RBX. So you do the compare, and if it's greater than or equal, the opposite of this condition, we skip over it. And otherwise, we have our call, our add one, and our go back to the start of the loop. Now, I compiled this with the compilers with several different optimization settings, and if I turn on a few more optimizations, I get this version, where the compiler said, oh, wait a moment. You know, here, in this original version, I'm doing an unconditional jump and a conditional jump every iteration of the loop. And it turns out I can restructure things a little bit to avoid doing an unconditional jump, so my loop ends up being 1, 2, 3, 4 instructions instead of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 instructions. Cost of doing this is have a little extra set of code at the beginning of the loop. So the compiler chose to do this just because, oh, that's probably a little faster. And if I turn on other optimizations, I got a compiler generate this code. Seems a lot more complicated. And what it's done here is it's changed this code from counting up to 10 to counting down to 0. And why did it do that? Because when you change it to count down to 0, this is your actual loop that you decrement. The decrement sets the condition codes, and we check whether we got to 0, and we avoid a comparison. Now, there's a lot of extra setup code, so this is only going to be worth it if we have a lot of iterations of this loop, because we have all this code up here to create our counter that goes down to 0 instead of up to 10. But this is, in fact, something a compiler will do. It's a valid translation. So showing you the straightforward translation is not always what compilers do when they're trying to be clever and get sort of the maximum performance. Questions about our while examples here? Yes. Is there an int command like there's a deck instruction? Yes. Other questions? And at the end of last time, we very briefly talked about compiling switches. I'll just go over that again with a little more calmly. So switches are something where it's not actually super straightforward in C, but the obvious assembly translation is. For while loops, we had this sort of very straightforward translation where we said we're going to like convert everything to if go to. For switches, it's not so obvious how to do that. So one strategy is we can kind of convert this switch into if A equals 1, if A equals 2, this kind of just sequence of if statements, basically, which is what this translation basically looks like. Here, then I'm comparing A to each value, jumping to the code for that case, I exhaust it. And this is something compilers sometimes do. We could also do something where we do a binary search, so we can say if A is less than 50, and then keep going if A is less than 25, and use this kind of strategy to find the case. And this is also something compilers would do. This saves a bunch of comparisons, probably worthwhile with 100 cases, maybe not worthwhile with 3 or 4. And we mentioned a third strategy, which is the compiler can say, we're not going to do any of that if x go to strategy. We're going to have a table. So the compiler will generate code that does this jump using a table. And what that does is we have this array that the compiler makes of the addresses of the code for each case. And based on the value of A, we do an array lookup. We get an address in that array. That address contains the code, the address of the code for that right case. And we run the code that that points to. And that's the code for, you know, in this example, it would be A equals 2. And this is something I mentioned especially because, well, this is not a translation we can really do with our convert the C code to simpler C code mechanism. And it is something compilers will commonly do. Questions about our switch statement options? Yes?
So why are the addresses shown on this line of jump in hexadecimal digit? Like, because I'm assuming that it is from an understanding that address should be like differentiated one hexadecimal at a time.
The question is why does my table of addresses here have every element differing by 8 instead of 1? So it's true in the memory we have 1-byte slots. Here I am showing the contents of 8-byte sections of memory because we're interpreting memory as an array of 8-byte numbers. So as far as how they would actually be stored, yes, they'd actually be stored as individual bytes in little endian order on our system. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So that's about switch statements. So we're going to talk a bit about how programs work. So you've, I think, seen something like this diagram before. So we have, when our program's loaded in memory, we have a stack at some high-ish address. The stack grows down as functions run and so on. Towards lower address, the top has the top of the stack is the bottom here. And the stack is where we put things like arguments that don't fit in registers, local variables, receive values, return addresses. We also have this region I label as the heap. So this is where malloc and new go. We also have some unused space. We'll talk later in the semester about what's going on with that. But we have a whole bunch of unused space, it turns out, including in between our stack and our heap. And we have this part down here. So we have what I label as writable data. This is like global variables. And I have code and constants. And this stuff is loaded from our executable file. It's not generated at runtime. This is when we start our program, this stuff is loaded. And generally, our executable file contains a copy of this, essentially. And the process of starting our program is copying from the executable file our initial values of global variables and so on, and our code and their constants into memory so we can use them. And we're going to talk a bit about how we make the executable file. And remember, we want it in this form where we can just copy it into memory and use it. Some questions? Here. Yes?
So the slide specifies that this is like for x86 and this is for Linux. How does this, like, I guess, convention change like in other operating systems?
This question is, how does this convention change? So the addresses are ones that might be typical in x86, 64 Linux, so that will vary a lot. That even varies on Linux. Most of this convention is similar on modern OSs, but it doesn't have to be, right? There's nothing that says you have to put the stack in the middle here and you can't have it at the bottom, for example. But most OSs have settled on this kind of convention. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So to talk about how we make executables, we need to talk about the steps of compilation. And I think you've kind of seen this, but you've glossed over in other prior courses about what happens in certain steps. So you have our C code here. For this example, I have my Hello World program. And that gets compiled into assembly. You've seen assembly before. We'll look at that some more later. And that assembly gets turned into something called an object file. But the object file isn't actually an executable, and it somehow gets made into an executable. So the question is, what's going on there? Why don't we just go directly from this assembly to this executable? And the big thing that we're missing here is that we need some other code. This object file here contains the machine code from here, but it doesn't contain, for example, most likely, the code for puts. So we need another object file to actually produce our executable. So we're missing some code. And the process of taking these multiple object files and combining them is called linking. We're going to talk a bit about how linking works. So we have these steps, compiling, assembling, and linking. So compile, convert to assembly. Assembly converts the assembly to machine code, but we still have to combine multiple pieces of machine code from different things together to make our executable. And with a compiler, you can do all these steps separately. So I think in 2150, you use minus s to just do the assembly step. You can take a .s file, convert it to an object file, convert an object file back into an executable, all as these separate commands. Very commonly, you'll do multiple of these steps at once. So for example, you can ask GCC or Clang to make an executable out of a C file. And it's still gonna do all these steps. It's gonna compile, assemble, and link. It's just not gonna show you the files it generated in the middle. It's just gonna give you the final answer. But it will actually do all of those steps separately as part of this process. It's not actually gonna go directly from the C file to the executable. It's still gonna generate the assembly in some format and the object file and so on. Okay, so questions sort of about our steps of compilation. Okay, so our main topic on this today is gonna be what's going on with object files, why do we need them? Because something we could do is we could take our assembly files and combine them. So here I have main.s and puts.s, and I could just combine these all both into one big assembly file, and then convert that assembly file into an executable. And the reason why we don't want to use this strategy, even though it would work, is that if I do this, every time I make an executable, I'm reassembling all that puts code. I would like to only have to do the assembly process on my library that I use all the time once. I don't want to have to do it every single time. So you want some way of sort of caching the machine code for puts, not using it every time. And a challenge with this is that part of making the machine code from this assembly that we're going to need is filling in a bunch of these addresses. So we need to fill in the address of string in that move instruction. We need to make these calls. I should have this highlighted too. All work. And that's part of making the machine code, but we can't really do that until we have this combined file. We can't do it from the individual pieces because our original assembly for puts has this call to putchar, and we don't know where that's going to end up. So we might not know how to fill that in that call. Because what we want is this. But if we want to have the idea that rather than do this translation all at once, we're going to first convert these 2.s files to machine code, and then we're going to combine them later so I don't have to keep reconverting the puts assembly to machine code every time I make an executable that uses puts or other things in standard I/O, you know, we're going to want to generate this machine code that needs to have something there. You know, that isn't complete because we don't know where putchar is, or if we're turning main into machine code to use later, we don't know where puts is. So we can't just generate machine code and use that directly because we still have these things to fill in. And object files are meant to handle that. That we want to have the machine code generated just once for one of these assembly files and use it later with some other ones, but we can't actually just use just the machine code. We need some other information to make that work because we can't generate the whole machine code. So that's sort of our motivation for object files. We're going to look at more about how they work in a bit. But first, questions on this motivation. We have object files because we want to generate the machine code just once, but we need some extra information alongside to make that work because we can't generate the full machine code. Okay, so let's look at an example of what's going to be in files in this step. So here I have a little more complete hello.c, and here's sort of what hello.s might look like. So I'll talk about some things in this assembly that might be a little confusing. This is sort of what the real assembly looks like. So I have this subtract 8 from RSP and add 8. You might say that seems useless. It turns out the Linux calling convention says the stack pointer needs to be a multiple of 16 when you call a function, and calling a function makes the stack pointer not a line anymore. So this is dealing with that. Not a multiple of 16, I should say. This XOR here is a way of moving 0 into EAX, which is implementing the return 0 here. There's also some other stuff going on. So there's this thing labeled .globalMain. What's that for? That's saying that main is used by another file. The code which calls main is not here. So we need to make sure main is accessible to other files that are going to actually call it. I also have, and I believe this is mentioned in 2150, I have part of this marked as text, part of this marked as data. The convention is text is the name for the code part, data is the name for the data part. So I have this assembly code, and we're going to convert it to an object file. And the main thing the object file is going to have, it's going to have the machine code. So I'm going to take this text part here and write out the machine code for it. And we'll say, wait a moment, we can't actually do that. How do I call puts? How do I find this string? Talk about that in a second. Also going to write out the data for the data segment. So I have this string here, I'm going to write it out as the bytes I'm going to expect in memory. So I have my machine code and my data segment. And my machine code, for the most part, like I have this subtract instruction, I'm going to translate that subtract instruction into the corresponding bytes. These are the bytes it generates. We're not going to go over, you know, the details of that, but I promise that these 4 bytes here are how you represent this instruction in x86-64 machine code. We also have cases where we're using, say, the address of the string. And I don't know what the address of the string is, so I'm going to just leave that space in the machine code filled in with something, some junk, that needs to be fixed later. So here I have a move instruction here, which is, this is the machine code for it, but I don't actually know what .lstring is, because I don't know where that's going to be in memory yet, because I haven't made the executable. So I just leave it as something, but I still have the rest of the move instruction. But we're going to need to fix that later. And similarly, I have a call instruction, but I don't know where putS is, so I just leave something there, which is where I need to fill in where putS is. Now, since I need to fill these things in, and we need to figure that out later, I can't figure that out from the information I have here, so I need to write down, wait a moment, this move instruction here is incomplete, we need to fill something in. So I'll have what's called, are called relocation. So basically, I'm taking some placeholders and that point to a location and making them point to the correct location. So I have this table of relocations that say, here is where I want to substitute something. So I'm saying, in the text segment, byte 5, there's something that needs to point to wherever this data segment ends up. So this is a note that I write as part of the assembly. That's for later. When we make the executable, we need to fix that. And similarly, in byte 10, index 10 of the text segment, I have this place where I need to fill in putS, this address, so I can call it. I don't even have the code for putS here, so I'm just saying there's some putS needs to, the name putS is what I'm saying, find out where that name is to make the executable, because this machine code is incomplete. So this is telling us, here are the ways in which we need to fix this machine code to use it, because when I made the machine code, I didn't know things, I just left them as junk. Because if I ran this machine code as is, instead of moving, say, the address of the string into RDI here, for example, I'd move a null pointer. It wouldn't work. Okay, questions? Yes. What does the BF correspond to? That is the part which specifies basically the move in RDI in the x86-64 machine code. Other questions? Yeah.
How does the machine code know that only leaving 4 bytes of memory is enough
for that? So the question is, do I have 4 byte places for the addresses instead of 8? So a detail I'm not talking about here is another field in the relocation table will be what format you want to put the address in. So the assembler could generate an instruction with an 8-byte blank too if it wanted. Typically, the compiler is going to try to use smaller blanks, and to make that work, we need to know that for example, this string is always going to be located at an address that's less than 232. And often the compiler will just say, if you don't do that, you can't make the executable, sorry. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we have these placeholders and this information saying, here's how you need to fix the machine code to actually use it. We also need to know where main is, because I told you main can be accessed by another file. We need to record where main is, so here I'm saying main is in this file, text byte 0. This is called, this table of these locations is called the symbol table. So the relocations are in our machine code. These are things that are incomplete that need to be fixed to make an executable. The symbol table is, here are things that other files might care about that are in this file. So one note is that .lstring didn't end up in the symbol table here. And sort of the convention on Linux is that symbols starting with .L are used for things that shouldn't appear in other files. So that's why instead of actually writing the name lstring, address of lstring here, we refer to it by saying, oh, we know that's at the beginning of the data part because the assembler could figure it out when it was making this object file without looking at anything else. So then, after we have this object file, we have the rest of our process is going to be making our executable. To make our executable, we need the actual code for putS, for example. So let's say that's in standard io.o. And to make the executable, we're going to take our code from hello.o and also the code from standard io.o and the data from hello.o and the data for like global variables in standard io.o, put them all together, and we're going to fix up these thing relocations. So we're going to say, oh, now that I've figured out where everything is, I need to put in the address where I put the data segment here, the hello world string, in this blank here. And as part of making the executable, the linker is going to fill that in. It can do that because it now knows where this orange part here ended up. And similarly, it's going to say, oh, I need to find the address of putS and put it in here. And it can do that now because it knows where it put the code from standard IO that contains putS, and it can look up in the symbol table for standard IO.o where putS actually is in that code to get the exact location. Questions? Process? Yes?
Sorry if you already went over this, but in standard IO, in the symbol table, would you put the addresses of the missing data segments in hello?
So the question is, what would the symbol table for standard IO.o look like? Yeah. So standard IO.o, it's going to be a very similar file, so we'll have some text and some data, and we'll have a bunch of relocations probably for things that like standard IO.o calls. And most importantly, we'll have a symbol table. And that symbol table will say like putS is the text plus, you know, 100 bytes or something. And that's the information we'll have. So the symbol table here is saying when you have a call to putS, make it point to 100 bytes into this text part. And that's the information that the linker is going to use to make the executable. So it's unlikely that this object file for putS is going to like reference the string, because why would the assembly for standard io.s, you know, the assembly for standard io.o know about any of this stuff? Right? Because it's kind of written independently. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
What's the point of subtracting 8 from RSP?
Question, why are we subtracting 8 from RSP? So the colon convention on Linux says that the stack pointer needs to be a multiple of 16. And this is ensuring that, despite the fact that the call pushes something. Other questions? Okay. So we have sort of our outline of how linking works. Let's do an exercise here. Okay. So test with your neighbors. So my question is, which of these contain the memory address of, say, hello? Which of these files? So we're going to take this main.c, we're going to convert it into an executable using that same process. So we're going to make an assembly file, an object file, and we're going to combine that object file with our standard library to make an executable file. And which of them would I find the memory address of, say, hello? Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, okay, D, okay, E, and F. Okay, so let's go through this. We have a plurality for C, but a lot of people think both B and C, so. So I guess a point of confusion here is that I wrote address for putS here. And it's reasonable to think, oh, that means we put the actual address there. That's not what it means. The note we're writing is that you need to fill it in with the wherever the address of putS ends up being. We don't actually know where putS is going to be here because, well, putS is in a completely different file that we haven't looked at yet. So this note is literally saying, when you figure out where putS is, use its address. It's not actually the address of putS. You don't know that yet. And similarly, in the symbol table, you might say, wait a minute, but the symbol table, we're going to have a symbol table entry for say hello, because it can be called from elsewhere. Doesn't that contain the address? And I said memory address. And what we have in here is the location in this object file. Wow. So that is a kind of address, but it's not a memory address, because we don't actually know where it's going to end up in the executable yet. So, questions? Comments? Follow-ups? Yeah?
Can you re-go over in the object file where .lstr is
stored? Question is, where is .lstr stored? So, if lstr was something that could be accessed from other files, we would need to put it in the symbol table. Since we didn't do that, just because we're not accessing over other files, but when we use lstr, we still need to specify its location. And I can't specify it with its name because I'm not storing its name anywhere. So what I did instead is I said, well, I realized when I was making this assembly file that it was at the beginning of the data segment, so I wrote in that the data segment location is what you need to fill in that blank. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So if, like,
question about another method?
That wasn't the main method.
That wasn't the main method, where that'd be stored? So if I had a, you know, a foo method here, then I would end up with a foo entry in our symbol table, which would be text byte and some high number. Does that answer your question?
Like, what if foo was local?
So the question is, what if foo was local? So in that case, I wouldn't end up with a symbol table entry, but a call to foo would generate something very similar to this, but referencing a part of the text segment. If foo was, I guess, like a static method. Does that answer your question? Static function, sorry. Question is, how does O know the address of main? No, it knows where it is in, it knows the address in the sense of where it is in hello.o, but we don't know where it's going to end up in memory. Question.
Does it know the address of the data segment?
Does it know the address of the data segment? No. So what's going to, so I guess I kind of glossed over the details of the format of the object files, partly because there's a bunch of them. And also partly because the object file formats are designed for efficiency. So like I've shown here, like I write everything out in hexadecimal. That's not very efficient. That's not actually what they're going to do commercially. But when I write the data segment here, we don't actually, we're going to say it's the data segment of this file. We're not going to say where the data segment ends up here because we don't know that yet. We don't know what standard IO.O we're going to actually use either. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we're not going to have the address of memory addresses decided yet in our object file, so the object file is not going to contain the memory addresses. Now the executable, it could contain the memory addresses because we have to fill in this call instruction with something like a memory address. So that would be a place where we might say, yes, it's in the executable. So that's, I think, a good answer. I would also accept something else because maybe we can call, because we don't necessarily need to actually call with the memory address. We'll see, talk about that a little later. So those are if call doesn't use memory address. Address, which we'll talk about why that would be later, even though we have to fill something in. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So another part. So asking which of these files are likely to have the literal ASCII string hello world. So what I mean by that is that these files, like their files are bytes. And if I open up this file and interpret it as ASCII, am I going to see hello world somewhere in there? That's my question. Is that like, is that something that you should expect? For which of these should you expect that? Give you a minute or two. And a thing to think about, the thing to remember here is the object files and the executable file formats that are used in practice are generally built to be efficient and fast, and not to like be read by humans. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks just A? Okay, two people. Just B? Just C? Some? B and C? Okay. A, B, and C? Few. And F, something else, some other answer. Okay. So B and C seems our common answer. So most people don't think the assembly file has it. So I think it's most likely the assembly file has it. Because if we write the assembly file like the top, well, hello world, it's ASCII, because that's typically how we store text files. And hello comma world appears in there. You can see it right here. Right, so it contains the string in there as ASCII, as a literal ASCII string. Like, it's actually ASCII. If I open it up in a text editor and search for that, it will find it interpreting the file as ASCII. Now, I agree, it doesn't have to, because, like, the compiler could do this and generate the string in some, write the string out in some other way in the assembly, and that would be fine. So, it doesn't have to. I think the top is more likely, but I wouldn't be shocked to see the compiler do the bottom. So, yeah. So then we have the object file and the executable file. And some of you might say, well, look here, your object file doesn't contain the ASCII for that, you just have it written out in hex. So I wrote it out in hex here, because I'm trying to write out the object file sort of in a human readable way, showing exactly what bytes are represented. But the object file format in practice is built to be easy for the linker to use. And what the linker needs to do is it needs to copy these bytes and these bytes to make bytes that can be loaded into memory. So ideally, they'll be in a form as close as possible to what we want in memory. And typically that means that we're gonna have all our machine code as the bytes, except with those things that are wrong in them, and all our data as the exact bytes we want in memory. And once things are in memory, we want them to be as ASCII with that null terminator, because that's how we represent that string. So I think in our object file, most likely we'll represent it as the actual ASCII characters because we'll use those bytes, because that's what it's going to be in memory. Yes, we don't have to do that. We could make an object file format where we represent it in some other way, but typical object file formats are designed to make the linker's job easier. The easiest thing for the linker is just to copy directly without any conversions, without like doing hexadecimal to binary. To bytes. And similarly for the executable, we want the executable to be something where we can load it directly from the executable into memory. So we could write out our executables as these hexadecimal characters like I've shown you here for human readability, but most likely we'll have them in the exact format, the exact sequence of bytes we want in memory, and in memory we want ASCII, because that's how strings work in C. Questions about sort of my explanation. So I think E is the best answer, but I can see the argument for D or for F. For D, if you think maybe the compiler doesn't write it out in the most straightforward way in the assembly file, or for F, if you think maybe we don't use an object file format that's more human readable and requires more processing, but I think E is the most likely answer. So questions? Yeah.
Sorry, I think I'm just confused because I thought you said assembly is probably like the most likely it has like a literal string.
Yes. So by literal string, I mean when we write the assembly for this, most likely we're going to write the string like this. And so like if I control F for the string, I will find it interpreting, and the assembly file is ASCII. Does that answer your question? So this is ASCII as represented in the file, and like it contains the string in the sense of like if I use a string and string operator, and I guess Python would be an example, like I'll find it. Does that make sense? Okay. Other questions? Some other people look confused. Yeah.
So
So the question is, you're not going to see the actual string hello world in any of the other ones besides assembly. So if you interpret the files as ASCII, you will. So if I make a hello world program and I try to open it up in the text editor, you will see hello world. You will also see a bunch of unreadable junk, but you will see hello world in the middle of that unreadable junk. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes, but it is true that for B and C, we don't typically open them up in text editors because it's going to be mostly not useful, but that part will be. The part that's hello world will be, because that's the format it's going to be in memory. Other questions? Okay, so some other little things about linking. So the type of linking I talked about, we produce an executable, it has all our code. In practice, often we don't want to do that. And a big reason is that if you think of executables in my system, a lot of things call printf or cmps. And with the design I've shown you so far, we would have to have, for every program on my system, would have its own copy of printf, cout, and so on. And that would be a lot of extra space. So what we often do instead is we'll have one copy of, say, printf, and on Linux it's usually in a file called something like libc.so, and all our executables will somehow call from that extra file. And the way this works is kind of like we're doing part of that linking process at executable start time. So when we start the executable, they're going to load this extra file that contains our copy of printf rather than having their own copy. And they're going to set up their calls to printf to call it instead of trying to call something internally. Often to make this faster to do, because if you think of our linking process, we have to change every single call. That's kind of a lot for like a big program. Often what the linker and compiler will do to make this faster is they'll have like a table of all the functions the program uses from the C library, and they'll change the calls to printf to do a lookup in that table. And that means when you load the program, you just fill in the table rather than changing every single call to printf. But the same principle is the same, is that we're loading the program, and we've done most of the work already when we made the executable, but there's a little bit of extra fix-up with dynamic linking as we load the program to handle these things that we're handle making sure we know where printf is that we just loaded, for example. And on most systems you're used to, this is the default mode of the compiler. So we'll do all the linking stuff I showed you within your program. So if you have a program with multiple C files, it will do all the stuff I showed you for those C files, but typically the standard library will get in this kind of way. That will be loaded at runtime, just so we don't have to have every single program you make have its own copy of all the C out and printf and so on, because that would waste a lot of disk space. And on Linux, you can use the LDD command to see what standard what libraries a program uses that it loads dynamically. So for example, for ls, even though ls seems like a kind of simple program, you can see it loads all these libraries. And this command shows us where it would load them from and what memory address it puts them in. Here. And even a simple program like ls uses a whole bunch of these dynamically loaded libraries rather than having copies of all their code inside it. So questions about dynamic linking? Our very, very brief talk about dynamic linking. Okay, so one other thing is that machine code doesn't always expect exact addresses. So sometimes it expects a different format. So for example, x86 has a call instruction that rather than saying to call a particular function by an address, says to call a function that's 4,000 bytes later. And the linker still needs to fill in that 4,000 or whatever, but it can't fill it in with an address, so the relocation list will have an extra field saying what type of thing to fill in. And that might be, for this call instruction, would be rather than filling in the address, fill in the difference between the address and the address of this call instruction. And the linker will handle that. This also means, as something that's useful for dynamic linking, that if we write code to only use instructions that have this kind of addressing, then we can put it anywhere in memory. And compilers will actually often do that. Questions about sort of other types of relocations? Say, if address or difference. Yep. Okay. So in our last 15 minutes, we'll talk a little about some C topics. Most of this should be things you've seen before. So one thing to talk about is data types in C. So data types in C actually vary between machines. We're going to assume the Linux x86-64, which means that charts are 1 byte, shorts are 2 bytes, ints are 4 bytes, longs are 8 bytes, floats and doubles are 4 and 8 bytes respectively, and pointers are going to be 8 bytes no matter what they point to. We're talking about some things in C that might come up, that's good to know, that are slightly different than might be used to in C++. So one thing is that C doesn't really have a bool type. It kind of does, but it doesn't work the way you expect from C++. And in particular, one way, it's not what you expect, is the return value of, say, x equals equals 4 is an int, not a bool. It's the integer 1 if it's true, 0 if it's false. And this might lead to the question, wait a moment, if we have 1 and 0, what about 2, negative 1? So 0 is a false value in C, including 0 cast to a pointer, which is a null pointer. Everything else is true. Negative 1, true. So we have values. We've talked a bit about strings. So we've done some stuff with strings in sort of our examples. And you probably vaguely remember that the way strings work is that their character array is terminated by a zero character, so-called null terminated strings. So here I have code which makes a variable hello that points to this constant string hello world that's going to be stored as some read-only data. And we're going to have our pointer, which is going to store the memory address of the H character, the beginning of that array. And I can do arithmetic on this pointer. So I can say pointer plus 0 or pointer plus 5. If I say pointer plus 5, it advances by 5 characters. I can then dereference that to get the particular character at that location. And I can also write this dereferencing as doing an array lookup. So there's this two different ways to access each of these array indices. And it turns out in C that these are exactly the same. I mean exactly. And including in ways you might not expect. So foo2 is exactly the same. Well, so for example, you can write it as 2 open brackets foo. Bad style, don't do that, but that is legal. It has a very precisely defined meaning because this is star 2 plus foo, which is going to be the same as star foo plus 2. Because that is how it's defined. Also, arrays decay into pointers. So when I use an array in a place where a pointer would work, it turns into a pointer to its first element. So if we have this equivalency, this means that arithmetic with pointers doesn't always work, correspond to this like normal arithmetic. In particular, it still works with non-bytes, which means that if I have here, I have an array of integers, which are 4 bytes on the systems we're going to care about. And when I add 2 to a pointer to that array, to the beginning of that array, that's going to actually add 8. The compiler is going to figure out, oh, I have an array of int, a pointer to int. Therefore, when you advance by 2, you actually need to go by 2 ints, meaning I'm going to add 8. So that's why this example here, after we advance the pointer by 2, we end up setting this 12 here, the second element 2 of the array, 2 after the first, even though that involved advancing the pointer by 8 bytes, not by 2 bytes. So questions on how pointer arithmetic works here? Yes?
So if we added it by 8, like pointer plus 8, would it actually add it by 32, or
Question, if you add it by 8, would it actually add it by 32? Yes, which means that if you dereference the pointer after doing that, it would possibly crash. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's do a little exercise on this. So here I have a character array, which I'm accessing using that both of those syntaxes. Who'd like some more time? Okay, a few people. So who still likes more time? Close enough. Okay, so let's see who thinks A, B, C, D, and E, something else, or crash? Okay, so almost all C, a few people for E. So I'll go very quickly through here. So we have our, we set our pointer to point to the beginning of the array. Remember, when we use an array as a pointer, it turns into a pointer to the first element. I dereference that to change that to B. I advance it by 2 to get it point to the second O. I set that using sort of the array syntax to Z. I have probably better style to not use the array syntax. We probably aren't thinking of pointer as an array. And I use the alternate syntax to set foo index 1 to A. I probably better to use the array syntax for that. style-wise, even though both work. So questions? Okay. So from what I've shown you, it might look like arrays and pointers are basically the same thing. They are similar, but they're not the same. So for example, if I have an array here and a pointer, I can assign the pointer to the array to make a pointer to the first element. Can't do the other way around. Just won't compile. If I ask for the size of an array, it will give me the size of all the elements together. If I ask for the size of a pointer, it will give me the size of an address. Doesn't matter what it points to. This I'm mentioning very explicitly because this is a common error I see people making in C code, is that they really want size out to take into account what the pointer points to. Sorry, it doesn't. It gives you the size of a pointer. And similarly, if I make a pointer this way, this will be the size of a pointer because this expression makes a pointer to the array, not an array anymore. That's about pointers and arrays. So I'm going to talk very briefly about things with structs, just because much later on the semester, and you're going to use this, I'd like you to be familiar with how structs work, which is a little different than what you're used to in C++. So here, I have a struct rational with a numerator and denominator, and to use it, I have to type struct rational. I cannot just type rational. That in C will not work. This is different than C++. But there's a trick that you'll commonly see used, that instead of, say, writing a type over and over again, so in this example, instead of writing unsigned int over and over again, I can make a type def to make an alias for unsigned int called uint and write uint. I can apply the same trick to our structs. So here I have a struct called other name for rational, struct other name for rational, and I still have to use that name with struct, but I can make an alias called rational that is just an alias that doesn't involve the word struct. So I can then use that alias rational later. And much code prefers doing this. People who don't like writing struct all the time will often do this sort of thing. But there's a shorter way of doing this. So here I made this struct version of the name, and then I made an alias for that. I could also, it turns out, define the struct in the middle of the typedef statement. Yes, that's legal. That's a thing you can do in C, is you can define a struct in the middle of a typedef. And you will commonly see this, this is why I'm mentioning it. And when you're doing that, you can omit the struct, the name that's tagged with a struct name from it. So you'll commonly see this syntax where they've forgotten to give a name that starts with struct, but they still have an alias and they're defining in the middle of the typedef. So I'm not saying, I don't really like this style, but it's very common, so I want you to know about it, because if you're using C code, you will see it. And that's what's going on. And when we do this, I should note that, so this thing here, I can make a variable by using struct other name for rational or rational. I can't do mix and match. I can't do struct rational, that's not legal. If I want to use struct, it's other name for rational. If I use other name for rational without struct in C, that's not legal. In C++, it would work, but not in C. Questions on the struct naming? Okay, so one other thing with structs is that they're reminding you that they don't work like they work in Java. So if you have a struct, in this case foo, where everything's set to 3, if I assign bar to foo, that makes a copy. That means if I modify bar.a, that doesn't change foo. This is also how things work in C++, but mentioning it because if you're used to Java, things don't work this way in Java, but in C and C++, assigning a struct is a copy. Okay, so one final thing about C. So C is a language unlike many others where there's lots of implementations. And how can there be lots of implementations? Well, people have written down what C is. And initially, this was done in a book called The C Programming Language in 1978. And if you look at the version of C described in that book, it's very, very different than modern C. Like, you would not recognize, like, function declarations in that version of C, probably. Later on, there were new versions of C, including ones standardized by standards organizations, starting with the American National Standards Institute in 1989. If you've seen the C option minus NC, it's referring to this standardized version. And this looks mostly like modern C. So all the things you're used to in modern C were written down and described in this document. There were some updates. So in 1999, the International Standards Organization updated the C standard, and you might have seen a compiler option like minus standard equals C99, and this added some features you probably thought were always part of C, like declaring variables in the middle of a block. Before this, the C standard, unlike C++, said if you wanted to declare a variable, it had to be after the curly braces immediately. You can't do it like after some other statements. It also added / comments, which in fact were not a part of C originally, and some other things. So one thing about the state C having standards written down is that there's these things that the standards don't specify. So for example, I have some code here, and it looks like it should do int max +1, which should wrap around. And therefore, this should output 0. If I compile without optimizations, it outputs 0, false. If I compile with optimizations, it outputs 1. And you might say, my compiler is broken. It shouldn't do that. The people who wrote these standards documents say no. They have decided that they don't care what the compiler does on signed integer overflow. So even though my compiler decided to compile with optimizations to always returning 1 without even checking, that is legal. Because there's this concept they have called undefined behavior. So basically, the people who wrote what C is have decided that some things, they don't care what the compilers do. The compilers can give different behaviors. They can crash the program. And one of these is signed, not unsigned, signed integer overflow. Also, a bunch of other things like divide by zero and so on are in the same category. And I'm mentioning this because, well, it causes confusion when, you know, things you try don't work. But this is just a decision they made when defining what C is that you should be aware of, especially if you're like trying to like take advantage of 2's complement and a few other things, some of which will come up later in the semester. Okay, so that's where I'll leave off today, and I'll see you next week.